Hi, this is David Clone, CEO and founder of the Holonai Network and director of their Behavioral Sciences Unit, and you're listening to the Holonai Network's Mindhunter podcast on Radio Haver.
Haver. It's not easy butchering people. It's hard work. You know, there's a lot more like me.
We're talking to serial killers.
Serial killers!
New terminology.
Are criminals born, or are they formed?
How do we get ahead of crazy if we don't know how crazy thinks?
It's easier to ask for forgiveness than for permission.
Welcome to the Holonai Mindhunter Podcast.
And we are back, the Holonai Network's Behavioral Sciences Unit, with their continuing investigation into the Netflix original program, Mindhunter. Semi-true, actually not even semi-true, true fictional history, fictional, historical fiction, I guess is what you want to say.
Yeah, there you go.
Embellished for the, sake of entertainment, but based on true events, the beginning of the cataloging of serial killers amongst us. And I'll be Dave the Clone. I don't even know if I'm qualified to keep leading the team after that butchered intro, but joining me also at the table, we have with us Mr. T.W. Brown, author extraordinaire and voice of Tangent City. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Just getting through another night. Glad to be here.
Yeah. It's amazing that we still have nights with people like this running around in the world. But yeah, you know, we're still here. Thank God. CJ Ripka, all the way from Saloon 7 Studios and the home of Grit and Grace, and another voice from Tangent City. How are you this evening, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course, man. We've started this together. We've got to all get through it together.
We're gonna do this no matter what.
Yeah, man, because this isn't light viewing. This is some heavy shit. And thank God. We have the Scully to all of our tench holding in the eventual fourth guy we get. Spoiler alert. Jennifer Earp, how are you? Welcome again to the meeting of the investigative team here.
I'm doing really well tonight, and I gotta say, I realized that this episode takes place in Salem, which is only about 3 hours north here. So me and TW can talk about the Oregon piece of this tonight.
I've been inside that building, so.
Hey, there we go.
It just keeps getting scary and scarier how close this team really is to to what goes on in this show. I guess it would be bad for me to be like, oh yeah, every time I pack to travel for work, I think about the BTK killer laying out his jacket and making sure he's got his rubber glove. Like, did I forget anything? Do I have my roadkill kit? My God.
There you go.
CJ, any familiarity with the any familiarity or closeness to the serial killer world you want to bring up at the beginning here?
No. You know, I guess I come from the one untouched virgin land of this country. No, nothing even rings close.
That is hilarious. I actually, you know, it's funny, if they wind up touching on this guy in season 2 or season 3, should the show go on that long, when the Iceman, who was actually portrayed by General Zod, Michael Shannon, not too long ago on screen, have some familial connection to that guy. So I will have something to throw in if he becomes one of the killers that is part of this show. But yeah, other than this weird way we started out here, how's everybody doing? What everybody think of this? This is to me probably the pinnacle episode of the show. It's definitely the halfway point. It's a high point. We get our second serious interview here, but anything spring to mind before we dive too deep in?
I'm going to be the one to jump out on the opening sequence that we get for this episode, because I mean, you mentioned the kit, the serial killer kit. I mean, that's what you have in this opening scene. It's a checklist. I mean, you've got duct tape, rubber gloves, all, I mean, he's got it all there. And then at the very last second, it shows him, you know, kind of whip out the revolver that he's going to bring with him to kind of display. Yeah, and I've got this too.
That's the K part of the BTK nickname, I guess. Yeah. Right? Yeah. But by the way, just in case things get to the point where I'm done with them, I've got this thing with me.
Yeah. So to me, that was the first time I was all the way up to this point. Because until I got to the end of the series, I did not know who this was because I had to go look it up. I had to go see who it was. I was like, there's got to be somebody real here that they're dealing with. And it just completely went past me. So once I knew who it was and I go back and I watch these again and I'm seeing it, I realized that all the way up until this episode, I was just like, is this guy just some wingnut? I mean, I was still thinking in the show. I kept thinking. And then when that happened, I was like, yeah, okay, this is the big bad, but it's a little late in the season to introduce him now.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, are they setting stuff up for season two or what? And, you know, like I said, then I got to the end of the series and did some research and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well,
there's a ways to go before they catch this one.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I never was sure if they were setting up a big bad for the entire series or for the season. I feel like because we were only getting these little bites and then nothing at all was surfacing in the main episodes that this guy was just going to be this, I don't know, like maybe sort of like a compass in a way showing us that, like, you know, no matter how good these guys ever get, there's always going to be someone out there who's just like operating and is getting away with it. You know, they're just in the shadows, in the periphery. Maybe even some of the work they're doing is going to be helping them get away with it. You know what I mean? Like when they start seeing reports on the news of a new form of investigative technique has helped us to catch this guy who's been killing people and keeping them in the basement. All the other people who are killing people and keeping them in the basement are going, oh, fuck, they know how to find this now. You know what I mean? And they have to like change their methodology or come up with a new way of taking care of business. So it's kind of like going to be interesting if we see this playing as like a double-edged sword. But the fact that it is somebody who's a real killer, that it is going to probably be somebody that they deal with eventually, it would be interesting if that's the bookend. If that's like how the whole show ends, is when they catch the BTK killer.
I thought it was kind of interesting how we've seen over the course of the last seven episodes now, we've seen these little snippets in the beginning opening sequence. And if you think about it, everything that we've been seeing tension for get a hold of, it's exactly opposite of what they're displaying in the opening sequences. What they're learning about the serial killer versus what the serial killer we're watching is doing, it's like, whoa, they've got a long ways to go if they're going to figure out this guy, because he's nothing what they're showing on screen for the rest of the rest of the
show. That's interesting.
Wow. Yeah. That, I mean, that's what big bads are made of. They're the guys that the superhero's regular abilities can't do anything to. You know, it's when Superman first comes up to Kryptonite that it's like, oh, shit, there's something that will stop me from being Superman. And, you know, and this could be the guy who's the final boss in the video game of the Adventures of Tension Fort. Speaking of the next level, though, you know what I mean? That's pretty much what the rest of the episode is. Welcome to the next level. Welcome to the world of Brutos.
Well, and it's all about the evolution of this aspect of murder. I mean, just like everything else, it sort of it grows with what, you know, what it becomes aware of. You know, I mean, most serial killers, and I can only say most because a few don't fit, but most of them aren't idiots. They're a little too smart for everybody else's good, you know. So adaptation to the current, you know, whatever's going on around them is not that unimaginable.
It's interesting. I was having a couple of heated conversations on Facebook today, as I tend to do. And and most of them all were starting at different areas of controversial, you know, origin, but wound up kind of ending in the same revelation of there needs to actually be, in addition to the way these guys are finding a way to classify and label serial killers, there needs to be a new classification of criminal. And that would be something akin to comic book villain, but, you know, the real life version of that. Somebody that's like way Machiavellian, completely intent on as much maliciousness as possible, but are so smart that their sociopathy is kind of horrifying. Like, think the Joker. There are definitely got to be some people that are kind of like real life versions of the Joker. You know, I think some of the characters on this show are even kind of verging on that, you know, and they're based on real life, real life people. So, you know, with the idea of some of the far reaching consequences that some crimes have, you know, false accusations of certain crimes, identity theft, you know, accusing somebody of being a terrorist, like, holy shit, you accuse somebody of being, you know, somebody that the TSA should watch or something, and that ruins somebody's life. I mean, you know, we've talked about some stuff like this on the show. We don't, you know, we're no strangers to that level. And I think maybe my thinking is going that way from watching this show. Who knows? You know what I mean? But Brutos here becomes sort of like a whole new aspect. And it's interesting to see what this does to the team, because it does cause some rifts. Mm-hmm. It becomes a touchy one, you know?
Didn't Brutos start out, was he like a gangster or something? Or am I thinking of it's one of the other guys it's talked about?
Yeah, Brutos wasn't a gangster. He was kind of just a regular Joe.
Okay.
Who had a penchant for photography and had a thing for women's shoes.
Women's shoes, yes.
Women's shoes will never be looked at the same after this episode.
And women will be looking inside before they put their feet in, that's for sure.
Oh, man, that was definitely something that comes out of nowhere. And I think that's the Silence of the Lambs aspect of this show. That's the I can smell your cunt scene for this series. There's another thing that happens in this episode that I've been waiting to get to, because I feel like something that we should probably be keeping track of, maybe, or taking note of, are all the people that are being run into in daily life that have maybe one symptom or one sort of sign of the signs that they're discovering in all their travels. And I think it's really well exemplified in that guy who demands or insists on having his middle seat, even though Tench is willing to give him the aisle. Anyone who flies a lot knows that if you've got the middle, that's literally like a death sentence, especially if the flight's more than like an hour or two. And so for someone to be like, yo, man, no, take the aisle, it's all good, I'll deal with this bullshit of the middle seat, and then be like, no, I think it is much better if I'm in the seat that's on my ticket. Like, that is the same level as I need the empty cardboard roll before I can give you another roll of duct tape. You know what I mean? That's same.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's sort of like, I wonder if we're going to be if we're supposed to be seeing those things as Easter eggs, because I feel like David Fincher doesn't have these things happen for no reason. He's a very methodical filmmaker.
I agree with you. I think we could be looking at some things, and it makes you kind of want to go back over the course of the last, you know, six episodes and see if there's anything else that you might have missed, because I agree. I think we are seeing those things. But then again, we all, whether it's television world or real world, we all display different traits of these serial killers, these narcissistic habits or these sociopathic habits. But it's when you have multiples of those things slammed together. And I think we really start seeing how, when multiples are slammed together, I think we're starting to see that clearly in Brutos, because his mannerisms, how he acts, everything about him. And there's some really fucked up shit about him.
Tread lightly, because you don't know what shoes you can use.
Right.
I'd like to give a shout out to Jenny Lee, who's watching us again. And she says, their sociopathy is methodically formed from very early in life.
Yeah.
So this guy who needs to be in the middle seat because that's what's on his ticket, you know, I mean, all these things are tied to, you know, again, that's too something they find out in all of these interviews, is that a lot of these conditions these people find themselves in, these violent offenders, start with weird confrontations with mom and absences of dad, you know, and I think that's definitely something they discuss heavily in this episode.
Well, there's also the case of some people like to just be a dick, you know. I mean, that's what they get off on. And that guy fit the bill with his, you know, his whole businessman sort of thing that he was sort of emoting throughout the whole thing, is I don't care what you, you know, lower level plebes want. And in fact, if I can be somewhat of a stick in your side, I'm going to do that because, well, I'm the boss where I'm at. So, you know, I'm just going to screw with you because.
This is Brutus you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about the guy on the plane. We're talking about the middle seat guy.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I think it was just a case of he wanted to be a dick.
Yeah, I saw it as he's just a nerd. He's one of those guys that has those rules and he don't break the rules.
Yeah.
He's the office guy, stapler guy.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like, no, this is a federal, this is FAA. This is a federal regulation. I am assigned to that seat. I cannot sit in another seat. Look, what if we crash and they find my body in a different seat? They're going to go after my family. I know they are. You know, it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? That's not, I swear to God, that is one thing this show is definitely getting right off the bat right there. It seems like it's just been forever. Airports is where the fucking crazy comes out in everybody.
Airports,
like my guy, yeah, mass transit in general, but airports, it seems, the most.
Done.
I don't know why. Is it because we're cramped in this very small space and we're flying way up in the air?
Oh,
it's real. Wherever I'm going to get away with something, that would be where it is, because they can't get away from me and they just have to deal with my crazy. And it's like, Jesus. You really think you're going to be able to get in front of all those people? Like, ah, oh, I hate it. I hate it. I feel like I'm about to be one of these serial killers over here whenever I'm at the airport. Probably shouldn't be admitting that over the air.
Get there first.
Have a sucker, Dave.
Yes, please. Anyone else has any stress relief they want to send my way, please, vibes, everything. we're open door policy here at the Hollow Nine Network.
I can send you pictures of puppies. I mean, I got a lot of those.
All right, now that's some serial. Hello. That's some serial killer shit right there. Speaking of sending pictures, that's something Brutus was into, by the way. Brutus is very big into photography. And well,
he overrated himself too. You know,
he what?
I think he was overrating. I mean, this was more of that delusions of grandeur thing too, because he saw himself as a photographer.
Yeah.
Well, I think so one of the things they discover in the course of interviewing him is he has this, you know, pathological liar thing going on where it's just nonstop. And he's in that category of liar that even when presented with, you know, infallible direct evidence of their guilt, they will still lie and claim that they are innocent. So we've got that going for us when he starts to kind of throw things at them like, oh, I heard you were able to get pizza and cigarettes when you visited Ed Kemper. And he, you know, he said you guys were idiots. You know, it's like he's really just trying to throw them off their game from the get-go. And it's, you know, the first openly difficult interview we've seen like this. You know, Kemper was happy to talk to them. Even Richard Speck was happy to talk to him at some point. But
I don't think he was unhappy to talk to him. But I do believe that he was screwing with him the entire time.
Oh, but yeah.
Happy to be down there, get his little time in the sun with the FBI and show them how much smarter he was than them. I think he was loving every bit of this.
I can see that. I can see that. But it's all, I mean, I think it's all part of the, probably even the thinking he's a famous photographer is part of a want or need for attention that is different than the way he was given attention by his mom. Like, you know, again, coming down to the relationship with the mothers, his whole thing was knowing that his mom wanted a daughter because he already had a brother. So she already had one son and she wanted a girl. And as much as he claims that wasn't why he was a transvestite, but he just liked women's shoes. And so it's interesting that then she got so pissed at him for wearing them. You know, like there's a lot going on there that in his mind just made him like, you know, just throw things out. Whatever's true for this minute will be true for this minute, because that's how I control the conversation.
Excuse me just for a second. I can no longer claim to be my state to be a virgin of anything tied to any of these killers. Jerry Brutus was born in Webster, South Dakota. So I just throw that out. South Dakota stew. We're the ones creating the crazies. Yes. I apologize.
What are you guys putting in the corn, man? What are you guys growing out there? What's growing in our food?
They weren't putting suckers out at the table for people to take either. So
that's just too bad. But I do like I do like about him is the same level of sort of comfort when he does reveal things that Ed Kemper had. You know, like when he starts talking about how he has all these subscriptions to shoe magazines, and he said this is my and Tench means he's like, so does that mean you masturbate to it? He's like, that's usually how that works. You know, like, I'm glad we could talk on this level, buddy. Thank you.
Also, something that's really common, you know, with these guys on the inside is they keep track of whatever it was that was their thing. A lot of them, a lot of the broken ones that you can count on coming back through catalogs and magazines and stuff like that. I mean, there was a very well-known, his nickname on the block was the Ice Cream Man. His victims were all very young, you get my drift, and he subscribed to multiple parenting magazines so he could cut out the pictures of the kids. You know, that was his thing. Yeah, that was his thing, you know. And so it's just, when I saw the thing with the shoes, it struck a nerve because I saw that, you know. I mean, that is how guys in there can keep track of that stuff, and there's nothing stopping them from it, you know. So they can continue to feed that sickness, and in that environment, he's been in there for a little while. By the time they start talking to him, by now his brain is done. He is basically psycho sandwich now,
forever.
Yeah, because all he is doing is constantly feeding it now, and there's no outlet, you know, any real kind of outlet, like where he was killing people, and B, he doesn't have anybody telling him it's wrong anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do kind of seem like there's a sort of friendliness to the way the guards interact with him. You know, like when they first start and he goes, you know, do you mind if we record? He goes, I don't know. Tony, do we mind? And Tony's just like, you got the paperwork? And they're like, oh, yeah, everything's pre-approved. I didn't approve anything. But I'll do it as long as I know I don't have to. You know, it's like this weird prima donna thing going on. But it seems to a degree to be something that's not encouraged, but at least tolerated by the prison system, you know, by the agents, if you will.
There's a whole hierarchy in there, and this does a good job of showing a little bit of that, because you know, guys that are well known for what they did before they came in, a lot of times do spend a lot of time talking to guards, and so. You know, and the guards sort of dig it, because, you know, then they get to go home and tell the wife, you'll never guess who I spent the last 4 hours talking to this afternoon. You know, like it's a thing, because you see it on TV. And so this person gets to be put in a place sort of elevated to a level that is some sort of weird star status.
Yeah, and now, it's like celebrity.
Yeah. And now this guy gets to go home and tell his wife, yeah, I just kicked it with him for the last 4 hours talking about, you know, the boxing match or whatever. And it happens all the time.
Hey, baby, you remember that necrophilia that I was telling you about?
Yeah.
I just hung out with them for a while.
Well, didn't they say the guys who were sort of guarding Saddam Hussein right before, you know, during his trial and before he was executed would, like, chat with him at lunch and, like, share their Fritos with him and stuff? And it's, like, this weird, what do they call that? Helsinki syndrome or whatever, where everybody starts to become friends because of this sort of forced bondage, closeness, bondage, not bondage in the S&M way, not bondage in the jerk off in shoes kind of way, bondage in like you're in prison, you are in bondage, you fucks, that's where it started. Bondage started somewhere else before it became a playground. And this is the bondage where, you know, you're in prison and they have to handcuff your hands to the table. And then it becomes a privilege for you to not have them handcuff the table on the next time. So they do have to do a little bit of conceding to Brutus to get him to open up the way he does. But once they do, especially when they do the carrot and stick, when they reveal that Holden has brought shoes with him. Mm-hmm. It definitely shows his eagerness to kind of tell his story. I think that there is this common thread we start to see where these guys do want to explain themselves a little bit for real. You know, Speck even got there when they had their conversation with him before he freaked out. Anything to that? Anything you guys are picking up as we keep going through this?
Well, the one thing in this scene that stood out to me was the way his eyes just, the actor does a great job of it. His eyes glaze over and his whole face goes black. You know, yeah. Like, just transforms the moment that coat gets moved and he sees that box of shoes.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That is his crack. That is his drug right there. It's so close he can touch it. And yeah. He's only had pictures of it up to this point, and there's the real thing sitting right there.
Yeah.
It really shows where this guy's head was. I mean, he was blank upstairs when it came to just sinking into this whole thing.
There's a thing with shoes throughout the whole episode, which it took me my 20th time watching to notice. And it starts, I think, when Holden and Debbie go shoe shopping. And we have him kind of questioning why he would need another pair of shoes when he has one that's perfectly okay. He's the very practical one. She's kind of like a hippie with a little bit of fashion sense. But there's this thing where she noticed where her feet are like bigger than they were the last time she bought shoes. You know, she's half a size bigger. Is anybody thinking Debbie might be pregnant?
Yep. Where my wine went.
Like, you know, spoiler alert. She doesn't have a baby this season, so I'm wondering if that is what is the sort of secret fuel behind some things that start to happen later.
Well, that's what's funny, too, is like that immediately that's where your mind went, my mind went. I don't know if these guys did also, but why doesn't their mind go that way? Like, your feet don't just grow after, you know, when you're an adult, other than one reason.
I hadn't even caught the fact that her feet had grown, to be honest with you. I missed that detail, so I'm gonna have to watch it.
Yeah, same here. I gotta go back now.
Yeah. Well, you know, she has a weird narcissism for how in touch she's supposed to be with psychology, right? And you know, she's like saying, you know, the guy even said, "Have your feet, you know, have you noticed that your shoes have been tighter?" And she goes, "Well, a little bit." And then she just goes, "I don't want to have fat feet." So I mean, I guess this whole thing is like saying, you know. We were in high school and they're like, what's the subtext? What's really going on here? She's going to have an abortion. Like, right? She's like, oh, I don't want fat feet, meaning fuck this. It's already taken care of. Like the minute this thought hit my head, this is pre-internet, but I already have an appointment, motherfuckers.
That's true, because the last episode when she was talking with Nancy, Nancy was like, do you want kids? And she was like, oh, no. And she's like, well, not yet.
Yeah, like, fucking no. And then, why the hell would I want kids?
Little foreshadowing there for us.
Yeah, I mean, it took multiple viewings for me to get there going. You know, I mean, I knew that that moment always stood up, because again, David Fincher, he's kind of like Christopher Nolan, like nothing's happening by accident. These things aren't happening and then aren't supposed to be taken note of. But like the discussion from either of them does not seem to be very relationship related. You know, Holden like either so oblivious.
Yeah.
Or he is perfectly, you know, becoming as methodical as the serial killers he's hanging out with.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so I just finished watching the weird scene of Wendy when she's at home and then she like goes to do laundry and then hears a cat and then brings the tuna can back for the cat. What the I don't still to this day after rewatching this. And I know there's like another, at least one more scene with the same thing. I'm like, what the frick is this for? Why do we care about the cat so much? I don't understand what's happening in this scene.
Well, that's interesting that you brought that up. I actually am aware a couple of things about that, but I think I'll let everybody else comment before we get into super spoiler territory. Which, by the way, I know we haven't said it this episode, but you know, always ready for the super spoilerishness of the way we discuss this, because we have watched the whole goddamn show already, guys. And we would hope that, you know, since it dropped on Netflix all at once, you will have as well. Continue.
Yeah, I kept waiting for her to find the cat dead and maybe mutilated to sort of
something
Pandora's box of, you know, most of these guys started off their serial killer ways, you know, on small animals.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
To kind of throw that, there was a scene in The Shield where Dutch actually had
yes,
and you know, and so I was waiting for something along those lines, you know, to happen, and I guess I was disappointed that it didn't.
There's just nothing. It was just like, why are we watching her eat dinner, do laundry, and then bring food to a cat? What does this mean?
She's
like
a crazy cat lady. What's her deal? Yeah,
exactly. Like something. There's no psychopathy behind it at all.
There absolutely is. They're showing the loneliness. What? It's the loneliness aspect.
Absolutely.
It's the fact that she doesn't have what Tench has. She doesn't have what Holden has. She goes home to nothing every night.
And okay. she gave up what she had to do this project, whereas their situation doesn't change as much as hers does. There is another element to it that I almost wonder if it's worth it to wait until I think next episode, because it's basically this episode sets this thing up and then the next episode this is paying off. But the mention already of, you know, well, serial killers often tend to start with small animals and then work their way up to full-on humans. There is something that came up in a conversation with show creator and director David Fincher, and somebody brought this up, and he said, well, you know, I have a totally different take on this from what the interviewer was asking. And the interviewer actually took your take on it, CJ. They were like, you know, well, this is kind of showing that she can't even maintain this distant sort of nurturing relationship. The only thing she knows how to do is psychology. She's trying to kind of just passively keep this cat alive, and eventually we start to see signs that the cat has disappeared, and that is supposed to according to David Fincher indicate that there's a serial killer or a child serial killer in the future, serial killer in the making, living in her building, and that they killed the cat. Now I think that's a little forced. That might be on the David Lynch level. So Fincher, you know, you're a different David. Let's keep it that way. But I kind of appreciate the idea. I like that it has that kind of a intent behind it. And it adds the overall, like, this show seems very calm and safe. Mm-hmm. But the creep factor is so fucking real. It's unbelievable. You know, yeah. I mean, it's going to just jerk off into a shoe right in front of you before you're ready. You know, you're gonna be sitting there watching TV with the fam. I mean, if you're watching this with the family, that's a whole other issue. Oh, yeah. But
your family needs therapy. So
sometimes TV shows can be therapy, man. I know somebody whose marriage was saved by Lost for a couple of years.
See, that kind of brings it all out as well, because you know we're getting so pulled into this that we're seeing things that, you know, may or may not actually be there.
Sure.
You know?
I mean, yeah. And we're trying to suppose what may or may not actually be there. And that's the same thing that they're dealing with every single day, that they're trying to create this solid case for what a serial killer is. And they're maybe now they're seeing things that aren't there. Maybe one of those will lead to an actual revelation. But yeah. A lot of times it's gonna be a dead end. That's the thing, is there's always more dead ends than there are real paved highways to be used. I mean, that's just the way it works out. You always remember the getting to the final spot. You forget all those dead ends you hit, and you know we're demonstrating that same sort of thing the way we have been pulled into the show, and now we might see something in, you know, oh, she stopped off and got soap downstairs from the machine. She sat on the dryer, you know. I mean,
you know, holy shit, we get to see Anna Torv in her underwear. Guys, get ready.
Yeah, you know, so
gentlemen, start your engines.
Yeah. Hey, women, start your engines. Thank you.
Everyone, start your engines.
I mean, it's Anna Torv. Come on.
And it's funny, like, does anybody remember that movie, The Great Outdoors, with John Candy and Dan Aykroyd? And there's the part where they're talking, the two wives are talking, and she goes, hell, sometimes I just got to lean up against the spin cycle. And the other one's like, holy shit, does that work? And she goes, have you ever seen whiter whites? It took me fucking years to understand what was being said. One, to like put together whiter whites. Oh my God, it's like an all commercial. But then it's like that came to mind instantly when she sat on the thing. I'm like, oh my God, really? Fuck, that was a thing? That was actually a thing. Jesus. I just thought it was a clever line in a movie. Fuck me. Some things turn out to be too real, and the adult world before I became an adult was plenty fucked up. All right, guys? So y'all paved the goddamn way for us. Yep. For fuck's sake. What else can we talk about along those lines? What other weird shit is this show callback to that it's just like, man, the world has come quite a bit of distance from this time, yet we still have serial killers. Tench smoking everywhere, to me, is one of the best indicators of the time period. He's literally smoking on every flight. He's smoking when they have Holden and Debbie over for dinner, smoking around the kids, smoking in the car. This is full on like, hey, fuck y'all. Get ready for your secondhand smoke cancer.
Yeah.
I'm Bill Tench. I'll be here all week.
So did anybody else kind of catch the odd fascination that that Holden was developing for
While they were shopping or later on?
Both. I mean, you see him sitting there drawing shoes.
Yes.
Stuff like that. Seems like his mind is just really occupied with the concept of like this shoe fetish concept. And it's almost like he's trying to really get into the mind of this guy by almost developing some of those fetishes.
Yeah, well, I was gonna ask, do we feel like this is maybe we think with Ed Kemper it's a fluke because it's the first one, but is this a tendency that Holden is displaying to become too much of a chameleon with the way that his mind is kind of trying to get inside the mind of these serial offenders? I mean, is this the first sign of the crack happening? The Berlin Wall is coming down between reality and what he's trying to discover in these profiles.
Or does it show the fact that his empathy towards these guys is being somewhat kept in a more healthy way? He could just as easily have gone down that road, but he doesn't. So it's maybe trying to say that this is more than what we know. This is going to go deeper. It's going to go to, genetic levels, to maybe to DNA levels. And he has that one chromosome that's keeping him from flipping the switch and becoming Kemper or BTK or any of these guys. But at the same time, getting into their heads every time he meets each one, taking a little piece of that and fixating on it so that it helps him understand just a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. I think he's the one thing he isn't able to articulate for himself or maybe even realize is that he has such a level of comfort with all of it. Tench is the one who's constantly, calling him out on it. Like, really? You're going to tell him about getting caught jerking off? You're going to tell him about your mom walking and jerking off like that? You don't feel fucking weird talking to them about this shit? And I like that his home life is supposed to be the constant barometer for how far away we are from what was considered the sort of typical, average, and normal. Like when they come home and the babysitter has found the photo that the son has had under his mattress, and it was usually the analog there is it's porn that's found under the mattress in little boys' rooms at this time. Okay. And mm-hmm. It's not photos from the homicide that his father is investigating with the FBI. And her reaction, I kind of, every time I watch this episode, I flip on whether I feel like this babysitter is fucking annoying and pisses me off, or is totally, rational and normal for having this reaction. Maybe you guys could weigh in, help me. Maybe I'm being too harsh, but I was really pissed that she quit on them. You know what I mean?
I think that I honestly think that she didn't overreact, because back then that kind of we didn't have the TV shows we have now with all the blood and the gore, and it's not something that she was seeing on a daily basis. And then to find it under this, had they said how old Brian is? Anyone?
I feel like I want to say ten maybe at the oldest.
Okay. Well, I mean, to find that under his bed, that's just, that would be creepy now, to find that kind of picture under somebody's bed. But like back then, when you weren't seeing that, you know, in the media all the time and blah, 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 that, I think she was totally just like super creeped out about it.
Like the fact that she was like, why would he even have this in his house? You know, the same question the wife asked later, that like is that she was almost like, I've been babysitting for a guy who has pictures like this, you know, like, holy shit.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Still, I kind of feel like I would have thought that she would maybe have, you know, accepted some kind of explanation from them, you know, because it was also, wasn't it also supposed to be like the innocent, naive time where like you listened to adults, and if they said, all right, you're just going to forget you ever saw that, and then they would forget they ever saw that, you know what I mean? So I don't know, maybe I just had a moment of sympathy for them, like, fuck, now we got to find a new babysitter. Like, yo, seriously, that is a big fucking deal. Yeah. Anyone who doesn't know what that is, that's a big fucking deal.
Well, and clearly it's a big deal because Brian obviously has some sort of issue, and finding a person that is able to help them in that way, and if you lose that, that's really, really hard. That's not just hard. That's really hard.
Yeah.
And you have to think, I mean, I don't know how many of us, I mean, have seen an actual dead body that has suffered violence or even a real picture, you know, not something that's blurred around the edges. It'll put you off, you know, and when you're, that babysitter's what, a 14, 15 year old girl, because back then, you know, I mean, nowadays, you know, people are thinking that babysitters are all 17, 18. They've gone to classes, everything else like that. But back then, whoever lived two houses down.
Yep, exactly.
Maybe they were almost a teenager, you know, and they're going to watch the 9 and 10 year old, but they're only 3 years older. I mean, how crazy was it? But this is, you know, again, and this kind of, along with what Jennifer was saying, you know, this isn't something that the eyes of the children of that era were used to seeing. And she had to sit there that whole time with that picture. And how many times, even though she didn't want to, how many times did she look at it?
Yeah.
That was a gruesome photograph. That was gruesome.
Yep.
What else is in this house? I gotta go.
Yeah. And you know, she probably called her mom, and her mom told her what to say. Like, all right, you tell them that we want you to apply for a job at the mall and that you're done with this babysitting shit.
Yep. So true.
And then there was also the fact that this then makes, you know, forces the conversation between he and his wife, and for her to finally get a glimpse of what he deals with. And it led to him noticing something in one of the photos that's going to lead to at least, you know, some new level of understanding with one of the cases. I know it was sort of like, you have to have so many things come crashing down on you or around you for you to finally have a breakthrough. And apparently that's, you know, it needed to happen. Maybe that babysitter needed to go anyway. Maybe she was literally on the verge of the next phase of her life where she becomes a raving drug addict. And if they had kept her on, she would have been throwing parties in their house and like everyone be getting wasted around the kid who already has issues. So maybe this is all for the best. And sometimes we have to invent these little things to make things make sense for us.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck that babysitter.
I love that. Put that on. I mean, you just did a whole different series.
Subtle marketing for a new podcast we have called Spinoffs that don't need to be made.
That was brilliant.
So what else do we have? We definitely have this weird moment of butting heads between Wendy and Tench with this sort of personal vendetta style review of him pressing Brutus on the cross-dressing aspect of his psychosis or his condition, and she sort of making it a personal crusade. I kind of love the way that the dynamics play out there, because we find a lot of the same shit happening now in the social justice warrior realm out in the world. Anything stand out to you guys about how this all of a sudden seemed to erupt out of nowhere and then also thankfully get fixed this episode?
We also don't get to see the buildup, you know, and that's the thing, because I had something really happen here that was close. It was a matter of this happened, and then a couple weeks later, this happened, then a couple weeks later, this happened, and then finally one day, I was having a crap day, and this happened, and then I blew up, you know? So we don't see all that buildup, and you have to know that with what they were doing, you know, and she's got her way, so you've got the academic way, then you've got old school way, you've got new school way, and these are all coming at each other from different angles with different ideas and different pushes. It has to happen. They have to lose their heads with each other every once in a while, because the pressure's going to get there, you know? And then that one thing happens on that bad day, and boom, all hell breaks loose. You
know? I mean, at the same time, though, is there supposed to be no significance to the fact that she is a lesbian and has not, that's something that they're not aware of? And so, so she has to, I mean, I don't know if I felt this was pandering or if it was sort of something that would make sense, because she also then is the one who's standing up for the idea of these alternative sort of, at the time, what were called alternative lifestyles. But the idea that, you know, they're trying to equate the fact that Brutus was a cross-dresser as a characteristic of his being a serial killer. And she immediately is trying to, is making sure that they understand that it's not exclusively tied to that at all. And that there's, you know, cases of this in history. But I think she then maybe tried to paint tension to a corner a little bit, whereas he, I think, was just innocently and naively stumbling through that new territory from sort of an old school mindset. And I feel like we see a lot of this same type of uncomfortability and unsurety of how to discuss these kinds of things. I feel like I'm doing a pretty goddamn good job of tap dancing around it right now. But, you know, this is not an issue that was just of that time. You know, the sort of way that this is even discussed is still something that's very fraught with controversy today.
Well, and back then, it was considered a psychological problem. Yeah. It wasn't acceptable mainstream behavior. That's why they were, quote, in the closet, because they were sick. There was something wrong with them. I mean, so if that's the case and she's a lesbian, then there's obviously something wrong with her.
Yeah.
That's the mindset. So she cannot allow that to be seen as a sickness. There is no way she can allow that. It can't. Otherwise, what is it going to say about her later on? Because she can't be certain that her preferences aren't eventually going to be discovered.
Yeah.
So, and then once that happens, they can say, we've used all your formulas and we're doing all this stuff right. And this is what we're seeing. And now, based on this, you are messed up. You know? So she doesn't need that coming back on her.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's the sort of immediate, you know, warrior, like I have to say something. I wonder if that's why she sort of was so quick to apologize to Tench, to kind of move past it. You know what I mean? The idea of like, let me not make it odd that I was so hung up on that. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I wonder, I mean, to me, I feel like when characters like this become an established team, there's the idea that that loyalty to each other and the fact that they trust each other with their lives is going to make them overcome any kind of differences of opinion about certain things that they may have been less educated about or less exposed to beforehand. I think that's what they call a character's journey, right? Where they like learn shit, get to a place they weren't at where they fucking started, the whole point in watching the damn show. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how that erupts, because I have a feeling the exposing of Carr is going to be something that probably comes into play. It doesn't necessarily come into play this season more than we've already discussed, but I think it's something that we're going to have to keep an eye on.
I'm going to apologize right now. The Debbie lingerie scene just came on.
So. I was going to say, I'm watching it too. And holy shit, this is probably what we should talk about. Does anyone want to talk about how they get it on? I mean, Debbie getting it on with the withholding is one of the high points of this show whenever it does happen, I have to say. But yes, okay. This is the where the shoe thing comes full circle.
Yeah. Did he, like, I can't tell if he liked it or not, but he's like totally staring at him like, oh my God.
It made him not work.
Right?
It made it go
like
offline.
About Brusco or whatever.
Brutos. Like, yeah. It's hard for me to remember things during this sequence as well. Well, she also, like, first is, like, she did the Susie Homemaker thing.
Yeah.
She was like, you know, usually their relationship has run the gamut of come over and fuck or come over and hang out while I do work. Yeah. And, you know, this was one of those ones where he thought it was come over and fuck. And she's like, no, I made dinner, so we're going to eat first. And then he's trying to be really, stumbly about it, but trying to really kind of praise her as much as he can. The way when he was making his toast, kind of like the subtle, like, we're getting the signs of, he's probably gonna say let's get married soon, you know.
Yeah,
at least that's what I get vibe wise.
It's definitely feels like it's going that direction
until this, because this is dessert. And dessert goes horribly awry. This is the baked Alaska getting water thrown all over in friggin' Scrooge. Do you know what I mean? This is like She had the gift, and you, for some reason, usually like the gift, and today the gift didn't work.
Yep.
Now, the thing is, though, did she put on the shoes on purpose?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think that because they've been talking about, well, did he tell her about, we don't really get any scene where he tells her about Brutus and the shoes, right?
Yeah, no.
No, I don't think she put them on purpose, but I do think that she believed that it's provocative. It's something that he would like. She was going all out for him, and then the thing for it just because it's like she was saying it's okay for you to have a little bit of a shoe fetish. I don't mind. I've noticed how much you've been drawing shoes and stuff.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it does show that there was a little bit of acceptance with the whole shoe fetish idea.
Yeah. Well, maybe that makes him more human to her because he's such a straight-laced guy. Finally, she found a kink.
True.
Ah, shit. Well, and I think the thing is, though, if she is trolling the things he's telling her about work to find kinks that might turn him on, that's probably a little bit dangerous territory, is it not? Like, he does work with fucking serial killers. You know what I mean? Like, what happens when it becomes like, which reminds me of one of these awesome memes I said, and I can't remember how it started, but there was something about like, oh shit, I don't want to break a nail, but tie me up and hit me with a shovel, otherwise I can't come. Something like that, you know, like it's on that level of this is how kinks work sometimes. But, you know, I think she was also doing, as much as she was doing Susie Homemaker, there is probably a friggin' Victoria's Secret catalog that said, hey, this is the it thing this month. This is the insta-fuck outfit for when you want to...
Now, Dave, you know that it wasn't Victoria's Secret. It was the Sears catalog. Come
Sears?
On.
Sears? Holy shit. Well, that's right. How long ago was Victoria's Secret, what's it called? Founded. I don't know.
80s? 80s?
Damn. Yes, I guess it was Sears, man. Sears had it all. You go there for your fucking, go there, build a car, go there to get bras, you know?
Exactly.
Yep.
That was a very interesting way to end the episode, too. Like, it was like all this build up, and then just like,
And I think it led to this new obsession on my part with Kiss You All Over by Exile, because that was like, it's like the one of the expert moments in which they use soundtrack in this show, the same way Scorsese did, the same way that Tarantino does. Fincher is very good with that. I mean, it's the same way, like, remember in Fight Club when that it ends with that Where Is My Mind by Pixies. I mean, there are people who had never even heard of the Pixies before that became Pixies obsessed just because of that sort of context that creates. And for me, I don't know why. I had already liked the song, but I remember it from Happy Gilmore. You know what I mean? When he was singing it through intercom. and I never even really, at that time, hadn't heard the song. You know, and I feel like there was a while where Adam Sandler was sort of like the gold standard on what classic rock was still cool. You know, so if it turned up in Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore, It was like, oh shit, cool dudes listen to that. You gotta listen to that unless you don't want to be a cool dude, man. It's like my friend's big brothers and shit. And yeah, I kiss you all over. It took on a whole new meaning with this episode. But what he says is interesting too, though. He says, this isn't you. And she says, that's the point. So,
well, she asked him, what, do you not like this? And he said, no, I love it. Before they got on the bed, when they were still standing up. But he kept like, it was like the constant glances at the shoes, like, no, I shouldn't like this. This is not something I should like, but I do like it, but I should like it, but I do like it. That I think is what the mental thing is, what screwed him up.
Or because it's, if I do like him, I'm too much like Brutus. I
might, there you go. That
I might too. Start killing people and taking their breasts and making paperweights out of them.
Yeah, that too.
or wall hangers.
Yeah. I mean, this is the worst case scenario of when you bring work home with you. You know what I mean? It makes your dick stop working. It makes your arousal systems go completely offline and causes problems with the significant other that could, you know, lead to the end of all things. And it's a great note to leave us on.
Hey, there we go.
You know, for the next episode in the Ballad of Debbie and Holden. And Brutus and Tench and everybody else.
Yeah.
Oh man, this was. I feel like there was more jam packed as far as different types of controversial topics in the shorter episode before this one than there was this one. I think it's any of the episodes that feature the interviews seem a little bit on the longer side, right? Because you need those moments for all the characters to kind of react to each other, and sometimes it's slow and quiet.
And this is that breath before the finish, too, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
We're going into the final three after this.
Yeah, especially if you're binge watching, you need that moment where you can sort of just relax because your shoulders have gotten up into your ears. You're so tight, you know? This is that moment where you could just chill for a minute and then hit the home stretch.
But then it leaves you like you're sitting there in the dark, almost like in that last episode of Sopranos, going, what the fuck just happened? And all you're hearing is, kiss you all over. And if you were like me and weren't quite sure what it was, you went and grabbed your phone and Shazammed it, and you're like, well, now I gotta download this shit. You know what I mean? Suddenly it's like the 70s are alive, the KBILLY up in the clone here.
I had that album with that song on it, so I had it on 8-track too. So
nice. Kiss you all over. And over again. Yeah, we're gonna keep doing the karaoke here at Hollow Nine. Karaoke. Don't think we canceled that. We had one entry last time. It was Blaine, so he won. We're gonna have some kind of version of his rendition going on there. But you know, keep an eye out for the next announcement, since quarter four is gonna be coming up soon. Quarter three, quarter four. One of the quarters, whatever quarter's next. So I think that brings us to the end of this episode. So much going on. My mind has been hunted. My mind is tired from hunting. CJ, Mr. Ripka, I feel like we kind of didn't hear a lot from you. So why don't you start off and tell us what's going on in your world? What's going on in the world of Saloon 7 and Grit and Grace and all the goodness?
Well, we've got Grit and Grace coming up. Changing nights. We're going to Wednesday night. We're going to be that late night hump week, hump day show.
Hump week, I love it.
Yeah, it's. I still got the image of Wendy coming out. You know, but yeah, we got. And then at the end of the month, we are doing a live road show. Lynn will be visiting the Black Hills of South Dakota, and we're gonna have some fun with that. So catch us end of June and probably beginning of July.
Sweet. Some hot fun in the summertime going on in the blogosphere internetica. Mr. T.W. Brown, what's going on in your world, my friend?
Just sort of wrapping my brain around the next writing project that I'm gonna start in July after taking this extended break, and holding my breath because I narrated for some people that have a substantial following. So it could be a real game changer release for that personality that I keep hidden in a dark room. But I'm I'm watching and waiting. This could be a big one for me, so I'm excited about it.
Prepare yourselves out there, folks. TW is about to be too expensive for us, so you may you never know what's going to happen next year at the Hollow Nine. We may need to rotate in some fresh blood. Going to hit up those interns out there. All right. Wishing you all the luck on that, man. That's awesome. Congratulations. And finally, Jennifer Earp, what's going on in your world?
Not a lot right now. I got kids. That's what's going on. No, kids stuff. No, we're going to be doing some more podcasting, of course, here pretty soon. Getting caught up on season 2 of One on Earp for the 10 Minutes in Purgatory cast. And then hopefully we can start doing season 3 right after season 3 airs so that we can keep up to date on that so we don't have to be so behind like we are playing catch up right now. So hopefully I say within the next couple weeks, look, some more content coming out.
There you go.
I'll say that.
Yeah. You know, there's content coming out all the time. If it's on one feed, it's on another.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Just hanging out over at the Hollow Nine, and you'll know what's coming up because you can listen to all the shows right there with our new player that has been added to every microsite. Thanks to the awesomeness that is Jennifer Nine, your co-host.
Yes.
Minutes of Purgatory, and she's got some awesome shows coming out too. You know, she's got the America's Psycho Sweethearts is getting ready to launch, and this podcast sucks. Which it doesn't suck. It's just about vampires. Like, for fuck's sake, guys, get this shit. It's not easy. It's kind of like right there and easy. It's not that hard. But, you know, when you get it, then you're like, oh, fuck. And if I didn't have to tell it to you, if, like, Dave didn't have to tell us that's what it meant, it's all the better. And I know you guys out there, it's just been a long week. Sometimes we get tired and we over-explain things here. Anyhow, so yeah, keep your ears to the grindstone. In July especially, we're going to do a 24-hour live pod-a-thon for a sort of a one-year anniversary celebration, and maybe people will throw some cash for jokes kind of shit. We'll do some songs, do some dances, put Batman's head on the lance, whatever it takes to, you know, keep the lights on around here. Anyway, keep your ears to HollowKnight.com for all that good stuff. And I guess until we come back to talk about the investigation surrounding episode 8 of Mindhunter, you know, keep yourself centered. Don't get too attached. You never know. I don't know what's going on over there. A feed is being hijacked of some kind. Some sounds, some ghostly auras.
I think it's kissed you all over.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Till the night closes in. Yeah. That's such a good song, guys. Go download that shit. Exile, Kiss You All Over. Get the extended version, the full version of the song. It's 5.5 minutes long. All right, until then, I'm David Clone, and we'll see you at the next meeting.
Bye, y'all.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Now broadcasting from our new home on the web, HollowNine.com, where you can find info on all of our awesome programming as well as the team behind the shows. Leave us your feedback, join in the conversation, and be a part of the action. Find the Hollow Nine Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at info@hollow9.com or at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Join in the fun. Hollow Nine.